It is a center for higher learning.
It is a place with centuries of secrets in its shadowed halls.
This is where you have come to learn the mysteries of the cosmos.
Welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast.
They'll teach you things you can't unlearn.
Hello and welcome to the Miskatonic University Podcast, episode 145. This is the podcast dedicated to Call of Cthulhu and other horror and Lovecraft-related role-playing games. I'm Keeper Dan.
I'm Keeper John, and today we have a chat with award-winning author Stuart Boone.
I'm Keeper Chad, and yeah, that was an awesome conversation. Super fun. We covered mythos and folklore fodder hooks for horror games set in the UK, among other topics. It was just John and I, so, you know. So that...
And I'm Keeper Murph. That sounds great because I wasn't there. I hope, I don't know what else to say there. But we're recording this little intro after the fact. So Dan, what do we do next again?
It's the Campus Crier.
Miskatonic University Campus Crier.
Campus Crier's Miskatonic U student paper. Here's going to go through mythos-related news and feedback for the show. This episode is being recorded on May 18th, 2018.
Oh, right. So Squamous Studios has a couple of big announcements coming out. And the first one is that there is an expansion on the way for Feed the Shoggoth, the card game that many of us have played. Final play testing is underway. Art is in production. And a Kickstarter for this is expected to launch in the fall.
Nice.
Woohoo! Yeah. There's also a completely new game in the works from Squamous Studios. It's called Arkham Relic Hunt. It's designed by Damon Gregory. And in this game, players move their acolyte around Arkham, collecting relics and cultists to add to their cult and rack up points. Plays in about 30 to 60 minutes for 2 to 4 players. And it's tentatively slated for a kickstart in early 2019. So you can look for both of those guys, that's Badger McGinnis and Damon Gregory, at KublaCon in Burlingame, California this year from May 25th through the 28th, and that's like in 4 days.
Thanks for the calendar update there, chat. Lynn Hardy has a new scenario out called Scritch Scratch that will be available in the Cult Library on June 8th, just in time for Free RPG Day a week later. And this looks really cool. Congratulations, Lynn.
I'm excited for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that idea that they're not only just releasing it on Free RPG Day, but they're giving GMs the opportunity to learn it, to run on Free RPG Day.
Right. Exactly. I love that idea. It's great.
Very.
Wait a minute. How do I get that?
Through the cult library.
From the Cult of Chaos.
Okay, I'm in it, but I don't deserve to be.
Same.
Well, cool. That's totally great. But I want a physical copy, and I've already made sort of tactical commando plans for how to do that in New York.
You're sleeping outside the shop?
You know what, guys? I just found out it's not going to be available in New York. It's the only place it won't be available, so... Oh, well, that's too bad. Shit.
Are you serious?
No. Journalistic integrity. Damn you.
Yeah, that sucks, man.
Because I want it. There's only like 2 copies per store.
Dan, is there something
it's really
else?
Hard to get.
I think it's like 10 copies per store, but whatever.
Yeah, we'll see about that. You know what happens is the employees all like they get it first and they like pass it out to all their friends. I see you.
That's
I see
true.
You, stores.
Maybe you should befriend the local game shop.
That doesn't sound like me.
No.
You're right.
Too hard.
Actually, you're right. It doesn't sound like you.
Social skills? Nah.
Lacking.
So. Yeah.
Barely keeping it together.
No. Is there some
like
other...
Like the rest of the show?
Yeah.
Oh.
There's a new short film from Boom Studios called... Eldritch Code, which is also Eldritch Code, I believe, is based on a comic that had come out. So
yeah, it's based on the Cthulhu Tales anthology that came out.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah. Neat.
It's really cool.
Boom Studios.
And I watched this a little while ago. It's actually pretty good.
I haven't checked it out yet, but I will.
Cool.
Nice. I haven't had a chance yet.
UK Games Expo is having an all-star party lineup with a live audience adventure extravaganza.
Woo.
If you are attending the UK Games Expo on Saturday, June 2nd, you can be witness as Mike Mason, Benjamin Looms of Sirenscape. I knew I was going to mess that one up. John Kovlik of Dork Tower in Munchkin. Jason Bullman and Amanda Koontz of Paizo's Pathfinder. As they all play Call of Cthulhu, this is going to be one of those live RPG Plus events, and it's being hosted by Nightmare Live's Paul Flannery. If you are in attendance, audience members are going to get to participate. So they're going to, you'll have the opportunity to offer up game twists and other suggestions to really frustrate the players. So we've kind of seen that kind of thing at the, what was that charity event, you guys got to attend?
Oh, Extra Life, you mean?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah.
Extra Life. Yeah.
Very much like that.
Very similar, I think.
Similar concept. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That type of thing. Similar concept. So, there's a link in the show notes for UK Games Expo. It sounds really cool.
I can only assume Mike is running that Call of Cthulhu game.
Yeah, I would assume so. Just like at the Extra Life, wasn't Mike the keeper?
The final one, yeah.
There were like 20 keepers, and he was, uh-huh. It was like a funnel. Yeah.
Okay, so
all of us were keepers, yep. Actually.
So, yeah, I bet it isn't going to be as large as the Extra Life event was, but I think it's going to be similar, yeah, to that, just probably not the I didn't see anything about any kind of charity, so there may not be any money being exchanged. It might just be shout outs to the audience. Hey, give me,
oh,
what
I
should
see.
They face, yeah, next, yeah, like, you know, that kind of thing.
I wonder, right, how much it would cost to mail Mayor McPain to the UK.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, that would be so cool.
Poor Mayor McPain.
Because we probably have listeners go into that, just to drop that on the table in front of these poor, unsuspecting people.
I think the different investigators should be eaten alive by the giant John puppet head.
Oh, yeah. Nice. That
I like,
oh,
that.
Mama. Yeah.
We did leave it in a hotel room somewhere, I believe, but...
Yeah, we did.
Fail.
No, remember? I thought you were there.
No, yeah. It was too big.
It's just too big to get on the bus again. And
to wrap up the general news stuff here, the Kickstarter for the Miskatonic University, their restricted collection board game, finished out very successfully with $106,944 of their $25,000 initial funding goal.
Yay!
Congratulations, guys.
Yeah. I was in on the $25 level, so I'm getting a copy of the game.
Yeah, me
lucky.
Too.
Lucky.
I don't
lucky.
Expect to ever play it.
Oh, wait. But, I mean, suitcase space in 2019, perhaps, because I'm waiting for someone who backed it to run me through it.
It's definitely a portable size game. So yeah.
Really? It's not very big. Oh. Yeah. Well, yeah. The box is 8 inches by 6 inches.
Yeah, that's packable, man.
Yeah, it's small.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's mostly cards.
Yeah, which is why the funding goal was so low. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you look at it and compared to some other games, you might go, oh, $106,000. That doesn't seem like a lot. This was a lot for this game.
Yeah.
This game funded very, very well considering the components that's with it and everything. So, yeah.
It's a card game with mats, essentially. I mean, there's nothing.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a huge.
It's a
overhead.
Yeah, it's a set collection game. So you're, yeah, trying to collect different sets, and I'm excited for it. I think it'll be great.
Yeah.
Big thank you to Sean for editing this train wreck of an episode. This has got to be one of the more interesting criers that we've recorded so far.
I don't know about that. That's a little overstating.
I don't know. We could probably make it more interesting.
And we've got some feedback for the show. First up, we got an email in from Daniel, and he says, hey guys, we've got Great, another great episode. It was great getting information from the source material about Sayaga. I've never thought of using Sayaga in a scenario before, but I am working on one with the Nagai. In it, the PCs are a TV crew for a cryptid hunter show. I like it already. Their newest episode is on the Loveland Frog, which is an existing cryptid if you haven't heard of it. And unlike their previous episodes that turned up nothing, this one turns out to be real, and the frog is a Nagai.
Nice.
That is a
freaky,
great concept. I love
it. Uh-huh.
Perfect. Love it.
You can't go wrong with the cryptid hunter thing. It's just so funny and weird and fun to play, yeah. Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
And then we also got a voicemail from our friend Brett Kramer.
Hello, Miskatonic University podcast. It's Brett Kramer from Sentinel Hill Press. I enjoyed episode 144, Darkness Deliver My Players Unto Thee. Just had a couple addenda I wanted to mention. One is that Nagai and I think a little bit of other coverage of Kayaga show up in the Keeper's Companion 2, in the article on like tomes, I think, and then monsters at the end of it, where they have stats of the Nagai, and I think, of course, they're in the Malleus Monstrorum. And also, one thing I wanted to mention is there's actually a fanzine called Kayaga. I think it's put out by, I'm not sure actually who, but it comes out, periodically, mostly Cthulhu Mythos fiction, very small numbers, I think fewer than 100 copies. So you might want to check that out. I can shoot you a link to put in the show notes. So, they're up to, I think episode 20 has just come out, if I recall correctly, I don't actually own it, but it is something that might be of interest to complete your Kayaga discussion. Anyway, so thanks for the show, and go Pods.
I kind of like his pronunciation.
Yeah.
Kayaga?
Yeah.
I like that as well. And the reason I use Sayaga is because that's how it was said to pronounce it in the core rulebook, but Kayaga I do enjoy better.
I do too.
Thank you, Brett. I'll have to look for that sign.
It's a zine.
I am just realizing now.
I did that on purpose. Jesus
zine.
Christ.
It is zine. Short for magazine.
I know. I did it on purpose. I know. Just
and
to
you succeeded.
I know you did.
Thanks.
I was so much later than you guys that I was, and I forgot that we were listening individually. So I'm like, guys, could you maybe not talk through the whole thing? I'm trying to listen.
Oh, poor baby. I had to listen to you and Murph over talking mine as I was listening at the beginning of it. So there.
Tomato, rude. Tomato.
I know, but I didn't say anything until now.
Thank you so much, Brett. Yep. I forgot all about the Keeper's Companion books. I've got both of them sitting down there on the shelf by me, but I didn't even think to pull them out and check to see what might be in there.
You know, I still need to collect those. I need to get those.
Yeah, they're very cool. There's lots of little nice tidbits in there. One of the problems I've found is that there are so many cool Keeper reference books that I really just lose track of what's where and what's in any of them because there's so much.
Oh, yeah. But they're fun to thumb through every now and then.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Ascarius Tabularis has sent us the sixth and final episode in this season of Glimpses into the Empire. He's taking a little vacation in idyllic Ravenna for a little while, but plans to come back for another series later on. So sit back, peel some grapes, recline in your comfy triclinium, and enjoy episode 6, The Heretic.
Salve, citizens. I am Ascarius Tabularis, and this is Glimpses into the Empire. The Roman legions are famous for being one of the mightiest fighting forces in the history of the world. The Roman Navy? Not so much. We Romans aren't known for our maritime expertise, and once this put us at a distinct disadvantage against possibly our greatest rival, the Carthaginians. The Carthaginians were an expanding empire based out of North Africa. And when our expanding empire met theirs, conflict was inevitable, with the stakes being supremacy over the entire Mediterranean. Now, the Carthaginians were fine sailors with a powerful fleet, led by brilliant commanders. And as one could not easily march an army from Italy around the Mediterranean to reach Africa, Rome would need to field a navy. How hard could it be? Enter one Publius Claudius Pulcher, consul of the Roman Republic. From a well-known and well-connected family, This aristocrat and politician had a very high opinion of himself as a naval tactician. With his connections, he got himself appointed Admiral of the Roman Navy and set out to battle Carthage. At first, the Romans did quite well, despite their novice status as a naval power, and won two battles off the coast of Sicily, which was still under Carthaginian control at the time, mostly due to a new tactic. But the Carthaginians quickly recovered, and all Roman advantage was soon lost. With a growing sense of confidence, the Roman navy blockaded the Carthaginian stronghold of Lilybaeum. The plan was to starve the city into surrender by preventing supplies from reaching the port, but the blockade was a joke. The Carthaginian fleet easily penetrated the Roman blockade, delivering supplies to the city and easily escaping back into the open ocean. This happened several times, once even in broad daylight. It was humiliating. Did I mention the Carthaginians were fine sailors with brilliant commanders? Proud, noble Publius Claudius Pulcher, admiral of the Roman navy, decided that his fleet would instead attack the port of Drepana, where the Carthaginian fleet was now operating out of. The Roman navy moved into position and made ready for battle, until only a single thing needed to be done. That being to read the fates to make certain that today was a favorable day for battle. So the augurs spread out some corn on the deck of Pulcher's flagship and released the sacred chickens to watch the pattern of their feeding to divine the will of the gods. Now, as I'm sure you know, augurs are the special college of priests that divine the will of the gods through the movement of nature, and there is no surer way to do this than watching the movement of birds, and in this case, the feeding pattern of chickens. Not just any chickens, sacred chickens. This was a science, after all. So when the chickens were freed from their pens and saw the corn, they just sat there. None of them would eat. Not a one. This was the most clear answer the gods were ever going to give to anyone. Today was not a good day to do anything. Publius Claudius Pulcher saw this and fumed. He had a timetable to keep, so he ordered his men to hurl the sacred chickens into the sea, reportedly saying, "If they won't eat, they can drink instead." He ordered the attack to commence, and the Battle of Drepana began. And what a battle it was. The Carthaginians spotted the novice approaching fleet, set sail, easily countered their maneuvers, and soon had the Romans trapped. Pinned between the coast and the Carthaginian fleet, the Romans could not maneuver, and the Carthaginians made quick work of them. Of the 120 ships of the Roman fleet, 93 were lost. The Carthaginians did not lose a single vessel. Among the few ships to escape this devastating defeat was the admiral's flagship, and Publius Claudius Pulcher returned to Rome in disgrace. Pulcher didn't have many friends left at this point, but he was unconcerned about possible punishment. You see, it was against the law for a commander to be prosecuted due to a military defeat. But many powerful people had lost husbands, sons, brothers because of Pulcher's ill-conceived plans. And the fact that he had the audacity to return to Rome alive was a slap in the face. So, charges were filed, and Pulcher found himself in court. He wasn't charged for losing the battle, mind you, or even surviving when so many of his men did not. The charges leveled against him were for heresy. He had ignored an obvious ill omen from the gods when the sacred chickens refused to eat, and then further insulted the gods by having the sacred animals thrown overboard. With the augurs and many of his senior staff testifying against him, Publius Claudius Pulcher was stripped of his honors and exiled to the border provinces in utter disgrace. His arrogance had taken him from admiral and consul of Rome to an exiled heretic, widely regarded as a coward. There was only one way to redeem himself and restore honor to his family, so he took it. Soon after his exile, Publius Claudius Pulcher died, likely by his own hand. So remember, if the gods of the universe are kind enough to send you a clear message, don't ignore it, because in the end, the universe always wins. I am taking some time off, as I like to summer in Ravenna, but I will return before the Ludi Romani. Until then, I am Ascarius Tabularis, and this concludes Season 1 of Glimpses into the Empire.
Very cool.
Uh-huh.
Cool story.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you, Oscar. And if
you, like I, are lamenting the end of season one of Glimpses of the Empire, don't fret. Oscarius has agreed to keep in touch while he's away and answer questions the audience might have for him. So if you want to know more about just who is Oscarius Tabularis, his personal life, his opinions on Roman history, politics, religion, and culture, or even about the shadow war being waged in the empire against the forces of the Cthulhu mythos, email them to oscar@goldengoblinpress.com. The cutoff to submit questions is July 15th. He promised to record a bonus mid-break episode where he'll answer some selected questions. The person who submits Oscarius's favorite question will receive a small bag of coins.
Oh, there's a page that's break cool. there. I know, man.
There's a page break. It causes John's brain to break as well.
Bag.
Of coins. Awesome.
Ooh, I win.
Oh no.
Now.
Oh no, we lost John. It's a small bag of coins.
Anyways, it's a Cthulhu Invictus Keeper screen.
Yeah.
In addition, and a copy of the fiction collection of short stories, Further Tales of Cthulhu Invictus as a prize. That is a really great prize.
Yeah, it is.
So I hope everyone takes advantage of this. Send your questions in to Oscar@goldengoblinpress.com and send him some questions and take an opportunity to try and win some really great swag.
Awesome.
For Cthulhu Invictus.
Yeah. And next up, we have got a segment from the strangest detention hall ever with Mr. Tyler, who's back to something totally weird.
All right, that's enough of that. While it is impressive you managed to pull a prank on Professor Wilmarth by claiming to be a farmer in Vermont being terrorized by fungi from Yuggoth, that kind of behavior lands you in detention here with me. Now, I don't want to be here any more than you do, so we're going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. In your next few detentions, I want to talk about my favorite great old one, Sath Ogua, and why I think such a chubby, lazy, bat-eared monster can be absolutely horrifying in a Call of Cthulhu adventure. As a preamble before we hit the interesting aspects of Sath Ogua and his connections to mythology and folklore and how that pertains to gaming, this week I want to address some of the ideas and misconceptions that do injustice to this terrific great old one. Sath Ogua has a bit of a bad reputation as sort of being the fuzzy, cute, great old one, or the lovable, lazy, great old one, neither of which really are that compelling at the gaming table, at least not in a horror game. He's usually drawn and art as sort of being a fat bunny or a koala, which isn't that scary until you think about the fact that all koalas carry a venereal disease and they eat their mother's poop when they're born. Sath Ogua's main appearance is in The Seven Geishas, written by Sath Ogua's creator, Clark Ashton Smith. Now in this story, Sath Ogua appears just like his description. He's furry, bat-eared, etc. But he also talks like a lordly, proud Victorian gentleman. But then again, so does the spider god Atlachnacha, the serpent people. In fact, everybody in this story talking a very polished prose style. The Seven Geishas is a mythos fairy tale. Like most fairy tales, it hides darker themes behind a curtain of predictably patterned storytelling. And most fairy tales do feature beings that don't usually talk being unduly loquacious. The Seven Geishas' greatest flaws are its greatest strengths, just like Sath Ogua himself. Sath Ogua is also famously a sleepy or lazy god. He's most often described as having half-opened eyes and a reclining posture. But sleepy doesn't equal cuddly, particularly in the Cthulhu mythos. There's nothing comforting about a sleeping great old one. That's what Cthulhu is, and his dreams cause global waves of madness to the artistically minded. Lethargy is a symptom of depression and a whole host of mental and physical disorders. Maybe in a similar way, Sath Ogua's dreams affect those living a lethargic lifestyle similar to his own, such as those in rest homes or crack houses or badly run prisons. In Greek mythology, there's a spirit of sloth named Aergia who guards the home of the god of sleep, Hypnos. Now, Hypnos lives in a cave deep underground. So, the spirit of sloth is in a cave deep under the earth. Sound like anybody you know? Is this an allegory that Sath Ogua lurks near an entrance to the dreamlands? One thing's for sure. It's going to be a great reveal when the players discover that the cult of Aergia are actually worshipping the Toad God. Sethagua is one of the most thoroughly described Great Old Ones. We have very carefully written descriptions of him in his stories, and we actually have sculptures of him by Clark Ashton Smith. The fact that he is so recognizable can be a little bit of a downside. However, that just means your players already have an image in their head that you can subvert and play around with. As a childhood sufferer of a dog phobia, I have no trouble being afraid of something furry. But for those of you not so blessed, earthly biology has a number of hair-like body parts that could be twice as horrifying if covering a great old one. Such as the fibrous baleen used by whales to filter their food out of the water. Earthworms have small bristles called setae all over their body, which root them to the ground, helping them move and prevent them from being pulled out of their holes. Or, the human trachea has cilia, a hair-like organelle that sweeps the lungs free of all sorts of detritus. The point is, if you don't want to be fur, it doesn't have to be fur. It could be a massive sense membrane like crustaceans have, or a host of alternatives inspired by the animal kingdom. No matter how cute his statues may seem, his loathsome bulk would be pretty terrifying face-to-face, especially after he's bitten an investigator in half. After that, who cares if he starts talking? But enough of my defensive protestations. Stay out of trouble, okay?
Nice.
That was really great, too. I loved the descriptions on how you can alter the fur and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is great ideas.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yep, I love that going back to the source material, which is basically what you guys did last time.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really super entertaining, ways to twist it and reinterpret.
Yeah.
I like the concept of it being like, you know, people think they're worshiping or you assume that that group is worshiping one type of God and it ends out being something else. I think that's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was really good, guys. I just finished listening to it. Thanks.
Oh, sorry. We should sound off. Sorry about that, man. That's really weird. All right. So be spontaneous, Murph, and go ahead. And
wow. It was great. No, it really was. Yeah. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And I actually had a link for something that talks about the absolutely horrible things about koalas. So.
That, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
They look adorable, but don't let one get anywhere near you. They have like every disease, all of them.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
But, so yeah, now we're about ready to roll into the main topic. This is going to be Chad and John, and they're talking with Stuart Boone.
Settle down now, class. It's time for your next lesson.
And we have on the air with us Stuart Boone, who is the author of Cthulhu Britannica, Shadows Over Scotland, and has his hand in the whole line, or parts of the line, I understand. And that's a source book for Scotland and Scottish adventures for the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game. Cubicle 7 was the publisher there. And he also has game writing credits for Chaosium, 60 Stone Press, Savage Mojo, and Golden Goblin Press, among others. And maybe we can get into what others means later.
And also, I just wanted to add, if I may, that for those who may not be in the know, Shadows Over Scotland was published in 2011, and it went on to win a number of awards, including the Best Role-Playing Supplement or Adventure at the 38th Annual Origins Awards. That was in 2012. Also the Best Setting at the Innie Awards, again in 2012. And the Best Adventure Collection at Die Hard Game Fan 2011 Tabletop Gaming Awards. So congratulations, Stuart.
Thank you.
No, those are nice feathers to have in cap. You have a feathery cap.
I do have a feathery cap.
A plumage, if you will.
Plumage, oh yes.
I've played a couple of adventures from Shadow Over Scotland. I don't have the book myself because a friend of mine who keepers is running those things over time, but I've really enjoyed it. It's a great book.
Fantastic. Thank you.
And you have, I guess, a number of things in the works now. We're going to talk about those in a little bit, but we wanted to start out by asking about your background in the Cthulhu world, how you came to the Cthulhu game realm.
Sure.
Yeah,
talk a little bit about your story there.
I probably came, as most people came, as a player originally. It was back in the 80s when I first stumbled across Call of Cthulhu. And a lot of the artwork of that first white box, I don't know if you remember, but that totally dragged me in, and I bought the game. And that's how I actually got hooked on H.P. Lovecraft. And from there, it was just a matter of, over time, of being a player and thinking, you know, at some point I'd love to give back. One of the main things that I was thinking, you know, I've had all this pleasure as a player. If there was ever an opportunity which I could give back to the gaming industry, really. And when I moved to Britain in 2006, actually. Shortly thereafter, I'd gotten out of role-playing for a while. Then I got sort of back into role-playing. And having traveled extensively around the UK, I kept sort of thinking, you know, why hasn't this really gotten the mythos treatment? Because it's, you know, there's so much here that you could play off of. One of the things I think that separates, you know, North American history from British history, European history, is the depth of it. And there was so much that you could call on. And in Scotland in particular, when I moved up to Scotland and settled around Glasgow, if you've ever been, it's this unbelievable sort of landscape. And the weather itself plays a huge part. It's usually rainy, pretty dark and dreary a lot of the time, but it's sort of perfect Cthulhu territory. So all of that played into my mind, and I was walking through every day I was walking through the Glasgow necropolis to get to work, and it just sort of happened with Shadows Over Scotland. I sent in a pitch to Cubicle 7. I think that was back in 2009, and to be honest, I heard nothing for about 9 months, and I thought, well, that's that. Mm-hmm. And then I remember that it was actually Valentine's Day. I got an email, and they were said, you know, actually, we're quite interested in this, and you want to take it forward. And I was like, hell yes. And then the only shock was, you know, it's like, oh, you've got 6 months to complete it.
Oh, great.
Uh-huh. So, but I mean, to be honest, I mean, having worked in the gaming industry for a while now, that tends to be the way it is. It's like last minute stuff and very, very word heavy. But it's been absolutely fantastic. And based off the success that I had with Shadows, a number of people came to me, which is, I think, a very pleasant situation to be in, where you're not sort of having to farm yourself out, but rather people are actually coming to you saying, could you do this? Could you do that? And so that's how I've subsequently got gigs with Chaosium, with Golden Goblin Press, and others.
That's fantastic. And so Shadows Over Scotland was your first Cthulhu game.
Yeah.
Is that right? I didn't realize that.
I was doing an interview with Paco Jean, and he was saying, you know, that I was like some sort of, I don't know, golden butterfly or something, that, you know, this impossible, this impossible thing that happens where, you know, your very first thing goes big. And it did go, it went huge. And it was a bit of a shock, but it was also really, really cool. And the only thing that I think you struggle with at that point is actually following up.
Yeah. Right.
It's one thing to sort of build towards greatness. It's another thing to have sort of, the first thing you do really, really goes well. And then everyone's like, oh yeah, show us what else you can do. So I've been sort of tinkering here and there in the years since. I haven't really done, well, I've done a couple of larger projects. So I did the folklore book for Cubicle 7 as well. And I worked on their London project as well. I helmed that.
You were project manager on that? Or
yeah, kind of. I mean, I was the line developer at that point for Cthulhu Britannica.
I see.
So that was, but then I sort of left that after that project because I started a PhD. So I've been working on a PhD part time, working full time, and still doing the as much as I can of the writing for games on the side as well.
Wow! Can I ask actually, what is that PhD in? What
are you PhD is actually in creative writing. So I'm writing a novel. It's written. Actually, I'm in the third draft. Hopefully the final draft of the book, supposed to be submitting for August. And it's based on, it's a story about two brothers returning from the First World War back to Glasgow, hoping to reintegrate into their lives in Glasgow, finding that difficult. But then things get very, very weird, as you might expect. It's a sort of mixture of historical fiction, weird fiction, supernatural fiction.
Oh, man, you're kidding me.
No,
sounds
seriously.
Great.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm quite pleased with it. I'd struggled for years to find a topic to write a PhD on, because most of my work is actually in academic development. So it's pretty dry stuff. And I actually happened to be teaching The woman who's now my supervisor, Beatrice Collin, who's a very successful author herself. And we got to talking one day and she said, you know, well, why don't you do a PhD in creative writing? And I thought, do we even do that?
Is that a thing?
So she said, you know, send me your stuff. So I sent her a couple of short stories and actually some of my game fiction.
Wait a minute. So that your game CV actually sort of contributed to
it. Did actually.
That's fantastic.
It really did. So yeah. I mean I've been really lucky. It's the long and the short. I've been really, really lucky.
Brilliant. Well, that is amazing. That is really, really amazing. I remember seeing speaking of some of your game fiction and game work, the Kickstarter for Stygian Fox's Sharp Little Needles.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Fear Sharp Little Needles. And you did a story. You had a short adventure in there, Resurrection.
That's right.
That was actually kind of a really cool concept. Can you tell me a little bit about Resurrection?
That's an interesting one because I was brought onto that project incredibly late. In fact, they'd already begun, and someone whose name I don't remember had actually had to drop out of the project. More challenging still for Stygian was that the person who had dropped out was actually the person's adventure who was tied to their cover art. So they had the cover art and they had no adventure to go with it. Steph got in touch with me and it was fantastic. And you know, just kind of said, could you do this? And I need it in 2 weeks, which you're going to see a sort of recurring theme here. I looked at the cover and it hit me immediately. I mean, that cover is absolutely brilliant. And I just thought, okay, but also something I wanted to do. I mean, that one's a bit different because it's I don't know if you've had a chance to actually read it, but it is very, very different. One of the things I'm always looking for is how to sort of mix things up with adventures. I don't always want to do the same thing. So in that one, it can be Lovecraftian. There can be a mythos intervention, or it can be absolutely straight, but played as a mythos intervention. So it's unusual that with that respect, it could be completely normal. And alternatively, you know, you can twist it on its head and it can be mythos inspired. So I like that. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, that's okay, brilliant.
So it's written with options, you're saying.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. And increasingly I'm trying to do that. What I like to do with my adventures is very much put it into the hands of the keepers. Because, you know, anyone who's run the adventures themselves, you inevitably change things. So I like to give people options. I love to be able to sort of throw things in and just say, you know, here's an interesting twist in the tale. What happens if you did this? And I've got some really good feedback from people on that, but I've also had bad feedback. People saying, just give it to me straight, you know, make it easy. But you can't please everyone.
Yeah, no. Sure. But and that sounds really interesting because as game masters know, the players are going to change and alter the direction of flow. And so having those options and being able to have a toolbox for the game master to go, you know what, I'm gonna take this piece instead, or I'm gonna alter this, and having the author able to provide as many tools as possible is great. So I can appreciate that.
I'm totally with you on that because, I mean, as a frequent game master myself, I happen to have a group of people who constantly break scenarios. It's sure. Just like their lot in life that they want to destroy the scenario. So I think really, really fast on my feet quite often. And I just thought, like you said, you know, that if there was already some hint as to where this could go, if it goes sideways, where does it go? I think that's a useful thing for keepers. So I love to put that sort of info in.
That's great.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's in Unspeakable Oath, they have I'm forgetting what it's called now, and I'm going to get feedback about that. But in I think in the Delta Green world, there are these hooks that they put in Unspeakable Oath that are contingent. They have three different possibilities. So you have the little hook that you would give players, and three different ways you can go with it. They're not very long, but I like that concept a lot.
Mm.
It's a lot of fun. I just lost my show notes. Sorry. Oh yeah. So, and we did want to talk about something that we know is in the works for Cthulhu, Tales of Valor.
Yeah. This is really cool. This is, so again, Oscar Rios, president of Golden Goblin Press, got in touch with me. And he's been brilliant. Actually, I've worked with him a number of times already. I think this is the fourth project or fifth project I'm working on with him. He got in touch to say, you know, because he knows I have a cat, and we've worked really successfully in the past. So he said, you know, would you like to come in on this and pitch me something? So I did. I've got a scenario coming into it. It's Tales of Valor, and it's a collection of three scenarios in which the PCs, of course, are playing cats, which I thought was wicked. So there's three different scenarios. One is by myself, and it's set in ancient Egypt during the Fifth Dynasty. It's called Shadow Harvest. There's another one that Jeff Moeller is running, and that's, I think it's called Tales of Valor. Yeah, something in Latin. I think it's Triumphus, Felis Vera, or something like that.
Ah, cool.
Ancient Rome, so that's during the reign of Caligula. And then there's another one that's going to actually be Dark Ages Paris, 9th century. So really cool times, really unusual stuff, which attracted me again. Anytime I have a chance to do something different, I usually jump at it. But I'm such a huge Egyptophile, if that's a thing. Absolutely loved it. So I thought, oh, I've got to do this. So yeah, this scenario called Shadow Harvest will be coming out. And the whole Kickstarter for Cthulhu, I think it kicks off end of June. So it's not long at all.
Yeah, right.
It'll run, I think, just for a month. So to the end of July. So end of June to end of July. And but it's not just the role-playing part, because it's a two-book project. So there's Tales of Valor, that will be the RPG supplement, but there's also Tale of Terror, which will be fiction, edited by Brian Sammons.
That's great.
Loads of big names in there, Joe Pulver, Willie Michael, you name it. So, yeah, and this seems to be something that Golden Goblin Press has been doing really successfully, you know, even with the second edition of Cthulhu Invictus coming out and concomitantly coming out with a piece of fiction. So I think it's a really cool idea. So that's So the Kickstarter for that, not too long away, actually. What, a month? 2 months?
Yes.
Yeah?
yes.
Coming up quick. Imminent. Are you also in the fiction or just?
I am not.
Just
in the game? No. Okay. To be perfectly honest, the PhD is taking a huge amount of my time, as you might not be surprised. So I have not been. I've been doing sort of select pieces for people here and there, and so I've got such a great working relationship with Oscar that when he came calling, I had to say yes. But hopefully, the other thing I can talk a bit about is that Golden Goblin Press is also going to be coming out with a series of source books in the Cthulhu Invictus line, and I've been very pleased to be asked to write the one for Britannia.
Yeah, that's great.
This is coming later in the year. I think they plan for a tentative launch for a Kickstarter in late September. And I'll be writing a source book for the province of Britannia with sections also on the barbarian lands of Caledonia and Hibernia. And Oscar's actually contributing a scenario to that one. So that's going to be great. I think it's the first time. No, it'll be the second time, actually, we've been in the same book. And a couple of new faces as well. There's a new author named William Adcock. He'll be in there. Possibly a third scenario. I'm not sure yet. And there's already plans in place as well for there to be a fiction companion to that.
So, wow. Great.
Yeah, so I love the things that Golden Goblin Press is doing at the moment, because, I mean, one of the things that they really excel on is, you know, consistent, great throughput. There's material coming out regularly, you know, and Oscar's just done an absolutely amazing job with his company, you know, to keep up support for products. And I say he's a great guy to work with, absolutely fantastic to work with.
Yeah, we're big fans.
Yeah, you mentioned five, and I'm sitting here counting five different projects. So I know you were...
So let's see. If I go back, the first one that we worked on together was Tales of the Crescent City.
Yes, right.
If you remember that one, the Jazz Age New Orleans. So I did a module called The Quickening Spiral, which was I love that one. Great fun.
That's great, yeah.
So that was the first time we worked together. That was shortly after the success I'd had with Shadows, and he got in touch to say, would I be interested? And I was like, oh, hell yeah, for sure.
Ah, great.
The next one was, and this is why you're probably confused, is for backers of the Island of Ignorance Kickstarter only, I did a scenario entitled The Hourglass. So that's only actually available to people who are backers on the Kickstarter. That was the third Cthulhu companion, if you remember.
Yep.
Yes. Yep. Well, John's in that. John, are you in that one?
I am. Yes, I am. I'm in the core book on that.
Fantastic. And then the third one I did was the Cthulhu Invictus de Horror Cosmico. And I did scenario called The Devil's Mouth.
Oh, yes. Oh, cool. Yeah, I have not played or run that, but I've been eyeing it. It's a good
one. It's kind of fun because it actually relates back to the work that I did in Shadows. There was a seed that I put into Shadows, and so I can actually pull it out and flush it out and into Horror Cosmico. So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's an Easter egg to hunt for.
That's awesome. Self-referential on that.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, just trying to mix things up and do things a bit differently.
Yeah. And it's sort of the nature of the mythos to have those connections implied. Yeah.
Well, the Horror Cosmico was actually a really cool book because it was all sort of Cthulhu Invictus modules that had a relationship to one or other stories of H.P. Lovecraft. So mine had a really strong connection to At the Mountains of Madness. So yeah, you can probably guess what the main villain is based on that. But yeah.
And location-wise, something that you had, right? That's not a spoiler. Doesn't it take place in Britannia, or does it?
It takes place in Scotland, in Caledonia.
That's right. Yeah. Where there are mountains.
There are. Well, yes, exactly. Yeah, the rest of England, you'd be struggling for a decent set of mountains. But here in Scotland, we have no shortage of mountains, or bens, as they call them. Yeah.
Right. Snowdonia counts. We'll see.
Snowdonia does count. Yeah, you're right. That's what they do. Yeah, you could say the Brecon Beacons in Wales counts as well, for sure. Sure.
Yeah. Right. So, well, we wanted to talk about that return to Britain and how it, you know, it first inspired you. And you talked a little bit about how depth of history and the sort of the bleak weather all contribute to elements, you know, that you can pull on and amplify in that writing. What are the things kind of inspire you about the setting and what threads you like to pull on?
The people themselves are actually quite interesting. I mean, I'm Canadian originally, so I moved over in, as I say, back in 2005, 2006. And one of the things that really strikes you coming over as a North American to Britain is the reserved sort of nature of people here. And there's always sort of, at least from my mind, you know, coming from North America, where people very much wear their hearts on their sleeves and tell you what they think. That is simply not the case here. So there is a sense of mystery about even the people, you know, what they get up to, what they do. You're not necessarily going to find that out until you become a very good friend of that person. So, you know, and just the different activities that people do, going out into the hills, walking and things like that. Again, stuff you wouldn't necessarily do in North America. You probably pop into your car rather than, you know, go walking into the mountains, or in Canada, you might be afraid of walking into the mountains for not coming back out. I don't know, the whole culture sort of struck me. It's quiet, it's reserved, there's this depth of history. And the other thing, I suppose, that really, 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 talking about threads, is folklore. There is a tremendous depth of folklore. And if, coming from Canada, you know, you do have folklore in Canada, but you would have to say it's thin. You know, and one of the things I've always been interested in thinking of possibly doing is building on that folklore in Canada. But in Britain, there's just so much. So, I mean, if you look even into a relatively small section of the countryside, in fact, you could focus down to a county level. And if you take a look at the folklore, the amount that's there would fill volumes, books. Right. And I just thought, there's so much here to play with. And it's one of the things that really got me interested with Shadows Over Scotland originally was, you know, tapping into that. You've got this dark sort of brooding landscape that's magnificent. Absolutely gorgeous. You know, everything from the tall mountains to the beautiful lochs and the sea and everything. So I mean, there's the bleakness, but at the same time, there's heavy greenery. Absolutely fantastic setting for any sort of adventure. And the cities themselves are sort of, they're building up, but at the same time, they're crumbling down, and they're built on top of other ancient cities. And there's so much wealth of history and so much wealth of folklore. And that, I think that is one of the things, I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, what separates possibly the British infusions of the mythos from North American is just the depth that you can go to. The fact that you've got civilizations literally built on other civilizations, which you don't necessarily have to the same extent in Canada or the US. But I find that it's just this incredible wealth that you can tap into. So that's where that's certainly where Shadows of Scotland came from, and the book that followed on, the folklore, Cthulhu Britannica folklore, was absolutely drawing from that. So with respect to the new book, Britannia, one of the things I get to do again is go back. And because you're actually in the Cthulhu Invictus, you know, you're in the Roman time now, you're right in touch with that sort of tribal primal folklore. And that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, it's such an interesting time when Britain has a colonial aspect itself. You know, it is being colonized. That's a yep. really interesting sort of turn of what we might think of in modern history.
Indeed, yeah. And they wouldn't like to think of themselves.
right.
Yeah, absolutely not, you know, because, you know, Great Britain, as is still very much held here. And the fact is, you know, that we were just a Roman province. And very much on the edge of the world. So there's this wonderful sort of situation where you're literally thinking about Britannia as the end of the world.
Yeah.
You know, and what lies beyond that is such a great question and so much fun to plumb. So it's great.
Yeah, I guess there's a sort of geographical isolation that mm-hmm. will always be true because of it being an island, despite yeah. easy crossings here and there, or horrible crossings in some places. from Bergen to across the, but I, in that in Shadows Over Scotland, I felt like you pulled on that isolation a lot. Where yeah. I remember, excuse me for not remembering the scenario titles because I only mm-hmm. only saw it as though it was a movie that happened to me. But there was an island and a castle. I remember that scenario.
Yeah, the Forbidden Isle.
Forbidden Isle. So, yeah. So not only are you already in the UK, but then you're further isolated, not only in Scotland, but even more so onto an island, and then even more isolated because you're not sure what's going on. So it's just
absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the geography of Scotland lends itself to that because you do have these tiny islands where, you know, a clutch of people will live, or someone, you know, relatively wealthy might have come along and built a folly or built a castle. And they're completely isolated, and that sense of isolation is absolutely you clock that. It's something I play off of all the time.
It was true in the Inverness scenario as well, mm-hmm. in the sense that it felt. I mean, Inverness itself is pretty isolated, far
yep.
way up there above the two main population centers in Scotland, and it felt like social isolation is sort of like a.
Yeah.
Right, everyone's in on it type of feel.
That's right. Yeah, uh-huh. And that plays into what I was saying about those sort of reservedness. That as an outsider coming, you know, there will be all this information that is absolutely kept amongst themselves as secrets, or ways of being, ways of knowing. And as an outsider, so you know, if you're a group of investigators coming to that, it really is digging into the depths, discovering things, uncovering things. All that investigation that you want out of a Call of Cthulhu module.
Yeah, absolutely. So now you have, in ancient Rome, you have that sort of in spades amplified, especially if you're playing Roman characters, just absolutely out of comfort zone. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Hostile forces all around you.
Yeah. I mean, even in terms of the settled tribes that the Romans conquered, there were something like 43 of them or more. But then the moment you go north or the moment you go to the west, you're encountering Hibernia or Caledonia and, you know, the painted Picts who some of the original writings that you can go back to are absolutely fascinating. How they're basically saying these aren't human beings.
Oh yeah.
They can live underwater and they can do this and they can do that. And they, you know, eat each other's babies and things.
Right. It's
absolutely crazy stuff because they literally thought, you know, that they inhabited some other space. And that, again, feeds into a lovely Lovecraftian sense. You know, you're right on the border between civilized and the unknown, I suppose. And so the fact that I can play with that province and that sense of being right on the border between what's known and unknown, that is a fantastically fun thing to play with.
Yeah. Have you seen this show called Britannia? I forget who is doing it. We don't have to pull on that thread if you haven't seen it, but
I haven't actually. I know I've seen, I think Mackenzie Crook's in it and maybe Kieran Hines is in it. I haven't. It's not on Netflix or it's not on Prime. I haven't been able to see it yet.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I think it was produced by Amazon. Let's see. Yeah, it's a co-production between Sky and Amazon. Anyway, I will say, if you want a sense of how weird it is for Roman Britain, it's a good one to get inspired. You know, for those of you who are thinking about buying the book, because it just gives that sense that nothing you thought was was sure is sure anymore. Yeah. It's all upended.
That's great. Yeah, and I'll have to check it out myself.
It's weird. That's a warning. It's weird.
I'm a big fan of weird.
It's weird fast. Yeah. Well, I'm excited. I think a campaign that ends up there, where you sort of build a group of Roman type characters who mm-hmm. end up having to be posted in the woolly wilds and out of their comfort zone, would be very creepy and have lots of potential for atmosphere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not too dissimilar from, I don't know if you've seen Annihilation.
That sense of
there being a border between the real and the known and then the unknown. And that's very much what I'm sort of teasing out. And actually was the case, because you know that you've got two cultures coming literally against one another in this majestic countryside, and you know, people trying to kill each other, and the hostility and the thing that's fascinating is just how little they actually knew. You know, they don't know what to eat, don't know where to go, don't know what they're going to come up against, and that sort of tension, that sort of liminal space between what you know and what you don't know, I think is really, really exciting. So going to be really playing up on that.
That's
exciting.
I'm pretty excited that you're using Annihilation as a reference, because that really pushed my buttons. And
all right.
Now I'm seeing what you mean, but that's an incredible reference. I love that. The journey into the bubble of where nothing's clear anymore.
But it's, I mean, a lot of the sort of Lovecraftian tropes, it is, you know, the encountering the unknown that for me is the big attractor. So the fact that I can sort of turn it around and write it into the books is, it just makes it so much fun. You know, it excites me to write these things, and I think about playing them myself and what I can do for the keepers to make, you know, it as interesting as possible, and to have as many options as possible. That's what keeps me going.
Yeah. So I assume that perhaps you have a notebook somewhere that we would all love to be able to see. That hooks for the future, perhaps other pitches after the novel's done.
Yeah. No, I do. I definitely do. I've got one major project that I really, really am keen to push on with.
Fantastic. We won't make you leak that.
I was going to say, I'm not talking about it now, but definitely in the works. So, but the thing is, I've got to get the PhD done. So I've got to focus.
That's awesome. Amazing.
I feel like I ran my mouth a bit there. John, do you have anything spring to mind?
Well, I was wondering, only because I truly don't know this answer. You know, when I think about the Lovecraft circle of writers and a lot of the influences that today's scenario writers reference, is it different in the UK and in that European world? Are there other authors that haven't been as widely known, you know, beyond Ramsay Campbell and
Lord Dunsany and
Lord Dunsany? Yeah. Are there other authors that you might draw upon for scenario inspiration?
That's actually a really interesting question. And I'm probably different from a lot of other folk. I don't know if there's anyone particularly. I mean, often what I will do is go back to the Gothic, which is maybe going too far back. I don't know, but maybe some of the original stuff that would have inspired Lovecraft himself. I'll go there. I would rather go back sort of deeper into history. But to be honest, one of the things that, as I said earlier, one of the primary areas that I tap into, I go for folklore. And traveling around Europe is absolutely amazing because you can pick up books, of course, even travel guides that will hint about things. But then if you actually explore the folklore behind different events, different occurrences, different strange and weird events within Britain, within Scotland, within Europe wider, that tends to be, I often go with, it might sound silly, but I mean, I've just written a scenario, for example, based in Switzerland for Chaosium. And it literally came about by taking a look at sort of folk tradition in Switzerland. And some of it is truly bizarre. And it just, the stories build from there for me.
Oh, awesome.
So I tend to go deep. I don't necessarily read overly much into the fiction.
Mm.
Except, of course, Lovecraft himself, I suppose, has started it all out. But I tend to go to history. I tend to go to folklore. And look for strange things because as a writer, what I tend to want to do isn't so much, I mean, the fear is that you write something and you think it's original and you find out, oh no, I read that somewhere else, you know, I've duplicated.
Sure, yeah.
So I tend to stay away from fiction per se and go to history, find weird things and then come up with a story in your head. Something that excites you and that you think would work really well as a campaign or as a module.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's sound advice for every writer. So I think that's fantastic. I'm putting that in my back pocket. So,
yeah, that is an interesting thing. Now I'm thinking about North America versus European and looking for that fertilizer to draw from. And it does seem in North America that there's a sense that because there's just not the number of years in the European traditions in North America to draw on. There's not a backlog of literature and known history, although there's plenty of history that's unknown.
And that's a fun thing to play with North America. And I think that's one of the things that Lovecraft does really, really well, you know, is tease out possibilities that aren't there, that weren't written down by the colonial powers, that weren't written down by, you know, the governments or whomever was in power, because invariably history is written by those people, but you kind of want to go outside of that. And I think that's one of the things that certainly attracts me to the work of Lovecraft himself and other writers, anyone who's willing to sort of step across those boundaries. That's the fun stuff, but you're absolutely right. In North America, I mean, if I think about it from a Canadian context, for example, you know, much of the history, it's written by Brits. It's written by the colonial powers that were there.
Sure.
And their takes on it are very British. It's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily speak of the First Nations peoples. It doesn't speak of their folklore. If it does, it's in a very negative way. And to think, you know, well, what if you actually go back even further? What if you go back to the core of their folklore, you know, the Innu or the First Nations people, and see what could have been there before? And it's that sort of thought experiment that drives me. It's that sort of thinking. Even in a European context, so going back to Switzerland, it's like, well, what's behind that folklore? What on earth, you know, this bizarre sort of parade or this bizarre sort of event? What in the world inspired that? And how did that? A lot of it ends up actually looking quite cult-like. You just let your mind go, but it's great fun.
Yeah. There's also a sense, I think, in North America of sort of creating the need to create new folklore. Yeah. So you have cryptids and you have urban myths and that kind of thing popping up. It's almost,
which is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. I mean, you don't even have to go back that far to find people, you know, with that kind of sentiment. Tolkien himself said, you know, that what he wanted to do was create a new folklore for Britain in terms of Lord of the Rings. So to be able to do that and to be able to create stories out of nothingness or stories out of the land or stories out of the weather, it's a very human thing to do. And certainly in terms of horror, some of the cryptids and some of the folk hero or folk horror that's come out in the US is really fascinating stuff. And you have to kind of wonder, well, where does that come from? What deep part of the psyche are you tapping into there? Great fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a bit of a Canada file, or in fact, I sort of feel Canadian. I'm from Maine.
All right. Yeah, close. Right.
It's a province of Canada.
That's right. Yep.
have you seen a Canadian map? They actually claim part of Maine. So you might actually be
Well, historically, you're not wrong at all there.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Upper and lower Canada, right? Yeah.
That's right. But so I'm always fascinated. I've always been sort of looking north to, I have, you know, Scottish background in Maritimes, and I've got, yeah. I'm French Canadian on my dad's side. So, there's isolation, and there's a lot of similarities in, say, Nova Scotia, for example. I mean, not just the name, but the sort of rocky coast and that.
Yes. Isolation. Scotland and Nova Scotia are actually the same tectonic plate. So it's
I didn't know that. Yeah.
So when Pangaea split up, it was actually the split was between Scotland and Nova Scotia.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. So, I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Yep.
And you also have, you know, this at least rumors of, if not some evidence of Viking influence. And so
Yeah.
Where would you most want in Canada to write mythos scenarios?
Oh, everywhere.
Yeah.
This is one of the great things that you can do with this game. And one of the reasons I'm constantly looking for new things, because I don't like sort of getting stuck in the sort of tropes, and you can do that. You know, oh, look, it's a port, so it's got to be deep ones. It's the far north, so it's got to be Knock K or something like that. I just think upset the apple cart, do new things, do cool stuff, and just put it where you think there's some seed of truth. Almost always build it off of something historical. So take a look at what's cool in Canadian history or US history or Mexican history, and just build off of that. But I'm not particularly, where would I suppose. I grew up in Alberta, in the sort of the West, and certainly the mountains there, the Rockies are a force to be reckoned with. But so are the plains in a way. I mean, the plains throughout the whole of Canada across three different provinces used to be underwater because, prehistoric, it was actually a lake, a massive lake. My mind goes deep. I'm constantly going back and back and back and back. Well, what could have been there even before that? You know, what might have been living in that space before and still living in that space, and dredge up some sort of encounter.
I love that I mentioned Nova Scotia and you go back to Pangaea. That's,
yeah, there you go. That kind of tells you what my brain does.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, Canada, that's a project I am considering actually.
Interesting. Oh. Talk to me.
Chad hit a nerve.
That's definitely. Yeah.
I've been thinking that for a long time. I just feel like there's so much untapped.
I agree. Yeah.
Absolutely. Quebec is just so, culturally, because of its sort of self-isolation and the language isolation and never really, this sort of perennial sense that we're really different than you all. And yet really need to be included. I mean, all of that is just a fascinating bunch of paradoxes.
It's begging for it, isn't it?
Yeah. I love it. And then of course, built on this strange, the British approach to the wilds, very early colonial days was very different than the French. And I wouldn't say one is, I don't know. I really don't want to make a judgment call because both were horrible to First Nations, in different ways. But those, I don't know, there's just some interesting stuff to draw out.
Yeah, totally agree. So I'll be in touch.
Oh, well, yeah, please. Yeah. I've got ideas. Anyway. Maybe we don't put that on the podcast.
Draw the attention sideways.
Right, exactly. I think we've covered a lot. I want to make sure there's anything else that we've missed that you want to make sure that we touch on here?
No, it's really been fun, actually.
It has been fun, yeah. It was a great conversation.
I can't think. I mean, you basically know the two projects that I'm working on ahead. So the Cthulhu and then the Britannia. After that, it's whatever I can do after the PhD. So it really opens it up for me.
I think we'd like to hear when your book, PhD book, becomes available, because it sounds like a fantastic premise.
Thank you.
Totally.
That all depends on how quickly I can find an agent and a publisher. My advisor has been absolutely fantastic in terms of giving me a couple of names. And in fact, the last time I met with her, she actually said to me, you know, polish up or just, you know, write up some sort of synopsis and give them the first five chapters because people are going to bite at it. So that was a very flattering thing to hear. So I don't know, but hopefully soon. I'm not even sure how long the sort of publication, the regular route to publication takes. If I self-published, that would be different, but I definitely would want to at least attempt to get it published to a decent publisher.
Well, in my fantasy world, I like to imagine that 50% of our listening audience is agents and publishers. So,
wow. Oh, I like the sound of that. Right. I really like the sound of that.
My dad is thin on this, but yeah, I like to think that's true. And hopefully somebody will hear the call for help.
Somebody knows a guy who knows a guy.
That exactly. Would be grand. That would be grand. Yep.
Well, I've had so much fun. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. Yeah.
Thank you for coming on today.
Really, really pleased. It was brilliant to talk to you all.
Yeah, and we want to hear from our listeners. We have a lot of different ways you can reach out to us.
For the complete list, check out our show notes. That's where you'll find our email address, which is mup.feedback@gmail.com, as well as the phone number, SpeakPipe link, and our forums.
Send us your questions, feedback, and topic ideas, or join a discussion. Record a liner, tell us who you are, and give us a hearty Go Pods for our home team, the Fightin' Cephalopods.
Find all the links you need to keep in touch at mu-podcast.com/1-4-5.
Thanks for joining us for another episode. Class is dismissed.
The Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is property of Chaosium, Inc. The written works of H.P. Lovecraft are held in the United States public domain. All other works mentioned in this podcast are the property of their respective owners. Original content of this show is copyright of the Miskatonic University Podcast under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license.
Campus Crier's Miskatonic EU student paper. Here's going to go through Mythos-related news and feedback for the show. This episode is being recorded on May 18th, 2018.
Man, you are dyslexic tonight, bro.
We could just lie. It'll drop on the 24th, so no one will know.
Dan's from the future. Are there flying cars where you're from, Dan?
Please let there be flying cars and biplanes.
Hello, hello.
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 Hello. This is a lot of fun. How long can we do this? I can hear you, Stuart. I don't think John can hear us.
No, I don't think John can hear us.
Oh, he can hear us, but
I hear you. Then?
We hear you too, man. John?
Hello, hello.
Yeah.
Hello, hello.
We hear you. I don't understand.
You can't hear me.
Yes.
Yes.
Jeez, oh, Pete.